Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Coming up on the program today, why exactly all those health insurance policies are getting canceled? What exactly is an IPO roadshow? And who exactly thinks haunted houses are so great anyway? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. This is the Marketplace podcast for Wednesday, the 30th of October. Good to have you with us, as always. Kathleen Sebelius, the Secretary of Health and Human Services, spent three or so uncomfortable hours on Capitol Hill today being, it is fair to say, grilled over the various and sundry issues with the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare. Why the website doesn't work, whose fault that is, what insurance companies might be in for if things don't get fixed, and why some people's policies, lots of people's policies to be fair, are being canceled even though President Obama promised early and often as he was trying to get the health law passed that if you like your health insurance, you will be able to keep your health insurance. Sarah Cliff is the health policy reporter at The Washington Post. Sarah, it's good to have you here.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
This idea of policies being canceled, why is it happening and why is it happening now?
Part of it is political, and some of it is also timing, that a lot of people who buy their own insurance policies, and we're talking about 15 million people in the United States, they buy them on an annual basis. So if they have a policy that will be ending in January, right now is when they're getting notices from their insurance company about what will happen to their policy next year, and they're going to have to switch to a different plan for 2014.
Why are these plans not being offered, though? Because the president promised.
He did. And I think, as you know, we've learned over the past few days, that probably was not the wisest. I would add, these cancellations, they're not a bug of the Affordable Care Act. They're actually a key feature. One of the things that the drafters of the health care law wanted to do was they wanted to increase the robustness of insurance policies. Right now, 9% of individual plans, for example, won't cover prescription drugs. 62% won't cover maternity care. And that's why you see these cancellation notices, that the Affordable Care Act is saying you can't offer these policies that don't cover this set of benefits we think is essential.
To be clear, even if I were a young single male with no risk of pregnancy, I would still have to buy under the Affordable Care Act, a program that covers it in the spirit of the larger you want comprehensive coverage and stuff that's going to protect against catastrophe.
Right. And this came up at the hearing today. Representative Renee Elmer said, you know, have you ever seen a man get pregnant trying to make the point about this? But, you know, if you're that young single man, it's, you know, possible you might get married. It's possible you might have a dependent who becomes pregnant. We don't buy insurance for the primary care checkup or the routine visits. The point of insurance is to insure against these big, unexpected challenges.
Just to the news, the other news of the day, the president is in Boston today making a speech on health care, and he is now embracing Governor Romney's plan and using it as a selling point for Obamacare. He now has to go out and sell this thing even more, doesn't he?
Yes. And, you know, I think one of the things the administration loves about RomneyCare right now is the fact that enrollment at the start was incredibly slow. Massachusetts only had 123 people sign up for their program in the first month. And that was ultimately 0.3% of everyone who enrolled that year. So you can expect them to seize on that data point and say, you know, Massachusetts enrollment was very slow and it worked out fine. So please don't freak out if you start seeing some low enrollment numbers.
Yeah, we'll extrapolate that 0.3%. I was about to ask you on the way out whether or not you think Secretary Sebelius is going to keep her job, but I'm reading the wires here in the studio as we're talking. And from Reuters, it says, White House says President Obama has complete confidence in Secretary Sebelius.
Yeah, I do expect her to stay in her job. And, you know, part of it is, you know, purely political. It would be impossible to confirm a new Health and Human Services head in the midst of this fight over the health care law.
Sarah Cliff is the health policy reporter at The Washington Post. Sarah, thanks a bunch.
Thank you.
Elsewhere in economic Washington today, the Federal Reserve said it's going to keep the milk and honey flowing, by which I mean cash. Wrapping up a two-day meeting this afternoon, the Fed said the economy still needs the help it's been getting from the Fed's big bond-buying program known as quantitative easing, and it put to rest, at least for now, thoughts that it might taper that support off. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith has more on that.
The government shutdown and the dismal job market have the Fed feeling less confident about the economy's ability to stand on its own. Bill Stone is chief investment officer for PNC Wealth Management. He says timing is critical when it comes to tapering off the Fed's bond buying program.
You don't want to take away those purchases too soon if you don't think that the economy will continue to grow without them.
Which has put the Fed in a kind of Goldilocks conundrum, says economist Michael Hansen with Bank of America Merrill Lynch.
If we go a little too soon, then maybe it causes growth to be slower, unemployment rate to be higher. But if you go a little bit too late, there's various risks around the possibility of inflation picking up or maybe some bubbles in financial markets.
Fed Chief Ben Bernanke's background likely means the stimulus will taper off later rather than sooner, says Keith Davis, an economist with Farr, Miller & Washington.
Ben Bernanke is a student of the Great Depression. And in the Great Depression, it's widely known that we removed the stimulus too quick, which caused us to go back into a pretty deep recession.
But, says Davis, keeping the stimulus in place too long and holding interest rates low can cause other problems.
As long as interest rates stay low, people will continue to pull money out of fixed income assets and put them into riskier assets like stocks.
And, says Davis, low interest rates and people moving into riskier investments to get returns is exactly how we got into this economic situation in the first place. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Traders took the Fed statement today as a sign things aren't as good economy-wise as they might like to have thought. We will have the details when we do the numbers. Less than a week, people, less than a week until the most anticipated initial stock offering since, well, since Facebook, I guess, so not all that long. But still, the Twitter IPO is going to be a big deal. Right now, the company is in the middle of what's called a roadshow. Just like it sounds, executives travel around the country getting a feel for who wants to buy shares and how much they are willing to pay. Marketplace's Abri Benishore reports it's not unlike another kind of roadshow, one you might find on your local public television station.
Lark Mason is an appraiser on PBS's Antiques Roadshow, and he's a lot like a skeptical investor. I asked him about this 7-year-old social media company I've heard about.
It has a really cute sky blue bird on it. How much do you think it might be worth?
Well, you know, there are a lot of ways to figure out value, so I'm going to have to ask you some questions.
Okay.
So one of the first questions that I have to know about is, what kind of condition is it in?
It hasn't made a profit yet.
No profit. That's kind of a challenge.
Well, it has 230 million users, and it's predicted to grow.
I think that there's good reason to think that it's got a pretty strong valuation at the moment, but as to the long-term viability, it's hard to say.
Now, the actual roadshow is a lot like that, investors trying to get at the core of the value of a business. Kathy Smith is a principal at Renaissance Capital. She specializes in IPO investments and has been going to roadshows for 20 years.
So they're clarifying questions, competitive questions, the strategy, you know, where the company sees its strongest business opportunity.
Chris Lowe, chief economist at FTN Financial, says the roadshow hasn't changed a whole lot in a few decades. It's still an invite-only event with big investors.
A bunch of brokers sitting around tables playing with their phones, paying no attention to a group of wonky-looking guys showing a PowerPoint and delivering it in a monotone. That's the roadshow.
But a curious sort of thing has happened in terms of the companies.
Some of these tech companies where you can be national just by being on the internet, the company often is well known and has a presence long before it reaches profitability.
With these kinds of IPOs, companies are having to prove their worth before they even turn a profit, which means they better have quite an impressive PowerPoint presentation. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
If you want to see the Dog and Pony Twitter Roadshow presentation, actually, it is just PowerPoint, as Sabri said. We've got it on our website. Check it out, marketplace.org. The list of challenges facing many African-American kids in this country is pretty well known. High poverty rates, lower test scores, worse health. They're more likely to go to schools that don't have enough. They live where crime is higher, and so on. So when we saw a report today called Being Black is Not a Risk Factor, we thought we should find out more. From the Wealth and Poverty Desk, Marketplace's Chrissy Clark reports.
Ever since Felicia Dehaney can remember, she's been hearing the depressing statistics her own daughter is up against.
The constant hammering down on parents and families in the Black community, just saying you're at risk and you're not doing well and you're at the bottom of every data chart that we see, it's defeating.
Dehaney wants to change that narrative. She's president of the National Black Child Development Institute, the research and advocacy group that just released the new report. The idea behind it?
Give folks some positive things and some data.
Like the fact that Black children are actually more likely to be enrolled in preschool than white children. And?
You know, more Black children have mothers with bachelor's degrees than mothers with less than a high school education.
Stats like these are especially important for teachers to hear, says Natasha Cabrera. She's a professor of human development at the University of Maryland and contributed to the report.
If you're in my class and I think you're not going to do well, how is that going to actually translate into you not doing well? Teachers' beliefs and expectations about children are a really important predictor of how well they do in school.
Expectations do matter, says John Jackson of the Schott Foundation for Public Education. But he says it's also important to overcome real-world barriers.
Barriers to access to health and wellness, access to a strong economic community, and of course, access to high-quality education.
Jackson says it's not just about changing the narrative, but changing the system that creates the narrative. I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
The EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, is going out on the road. This was day one of a cross-country trip to get public comment on its plans to tighten up on coal-fired power plants in this country. The differences of opinion, shall we say, between the coal industry and federal regulators are well known. But Sarah Gardner reports now from the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, things seem to be getting a bit more heated.
Busloads of coal miners and other union workers arrived in D.C. this week thanks to pro-coal groups like the National Mining Association. They packed hearings and rallies, all aimed at tearing down and occasionally making fun of the EPA's plan to regulate emissions from coal-fired power.
They're on a listening tour, EPA. Did you see that? Where are they having the hearings?
Kentucky Senator Mitch McConnell, he wryly noted that EPA head Gina McCarthy intends to skip over coal country.
I've invited Gina McCarthy to bring the EPA listening tour to Pikeville, Kentucky, and hear from real Americans that they're putting out of work.
Pro-coal forces are going all out now. Rallies, legislation, new coalitions. Last year, the industry spent $17 million lobbying the federal government. This year, expect more, because coal companies fear the EPA regulations will make certain what many analysts are already predicting, coal's long, slow decline. Republicans have already hinted they intend to make coal a key issue in the 2014 elections. Barbara Altizer, a miner's daughter who now directs the Eastern Coal Coalition, says she feels like the industry's invisible to most Americans.
Sometimes I think of our coal industry as the dead man walking. When they're talking about energy, you don't talk about us. My God, we are providing 40% of the electricity in this country.
Groups like the Sierra Club have been spending big bucks of their own attacking coal. It's in the process of spending $50 million for the cause, courtesy of New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Coming up.
You would have the option to go through the haunted house in the nude.
Of course you would. But first, let's do the numbers. A cautious day on Wall Street until that Fed announcement we told you about, and then shares dip. The Dow Industrial's off 61 points today, 0.4%, 15,618. The NASDAQ gave back 21 points, more than 0.5%, 3930 at the close. The S&P 500 slipped 8 points, 0.5%, ended things at 1763. IBM shares took a tumble off more than 1%. The company today dropped the legal battle to win a cloud computing contract from the CIA. IBM had been fighting Amazon for that deal. And Amazon shares, by the way, closed down 0.4%. Facebook shares fell 0.75%. That was ahead of earnings released after the bell. And those results were far better than expected. Thanks to growth in mobile advertising, shares jumped after hours. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.53%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Senate Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs Committee holds a hearing on housing finance reform. In South Dakota, Mount Rushmore National Memorial was declared completed on October 31st, 1941. And despite warnings that sugar makes children hyper, parents send their kids out to collect candy from neighbors, and in the time-honored tradition of Halloween, eat it right before bedtime. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. There was a refrain that was fairly common back in the darkest days of the financial crisis. What we need, it went, is banking that's boring again. That may or may not still be true, at least at the big Wall Street bank level. But down amidst consumers, technology is making branch banking, if not exciting, then at least kind of cool. Marketplace's Mark Garrison is on that one.
So you walk into the new Bank of America branch at 95 Wall Street, and you're struck first by what you don't see. There is no teller desk with tellers behind glass. There are ATMs, which you're used to seeing at a bank, and then there are the larger ATMs they have here.
So first you'll touch the screen to get started, and now I'm going to be connected with an ATM agent.
Manager Robert Barisi shows off the technology at the branch, one of six similar ones opening up this year around the country. The ATMs are bigger because they have tellers inside. Not literally, of course, but on those larger screens, customers can video chat with tellers elsewhere. In this case, Indira Saleya in Jacksonville, Florida.
Hi there. Welcome to Bank of America. My name is Indira. How may I help you?
She can make this ATM do things others can't. Forget your bank card? No problem. Just scan in your license. And you can expect a sound rarely heard at ATMs. Barisi wanted a quarter to pay the parking meter and some singles. That's easy for the able young woman on screen, but impossible for traditional ATMs, which are basically the equivalent of stupid toddlers with wads of $20 bills.
Is there anything else that I can assist you with today, Mr. Barisi?
That was it. Thank you so much.
But I still had a few questions for the faraway teller, so I asked her through the ATM what it's like working through the ATM.
Some of them have this wow effect. They cannot believe that there is a live person inside the ATM.
What do you tell them when someone asks if you're a real person?
I tell them I am a real person, and, you know, it's very funny, and it's an icebreaker, I believe.
These slimmer branches mean cheaper leases. Katie Knox is the exec in charge of Bank of America's retail banking.
We have 2,200 square feet. In our traditional centers, we have anywhere from 3,500 square feet up to 10,000. So from a real estate standpoint, we can accomplish an awful lot in this space.
And with cash secured in ATMs and handled by machine, security costs are lower and paperwork is minimal. Bankers get nervous when the question of saving money comes up. They start reciting talking points about tech being good for customers. But dismantling the teller desk is bad for people who aren't tech savvy or just prefer dealing with a real person.
We have a lot of customers that will look for the teller line, and that's why we have our specialists all around the floor with their tablets so that they can assist the customer.
At this Bank of America location and other companies' neo branches, staffers' tablets are literally strapped to their hands, kind of like pinstriped cyborgs. Those workers aren't just there to shepherd the technically challenged. They're selling the bank's products.
Welcome to Bank of NCR.
Some of the money banks spend modernizing branches ends up here, the suburban Atlanta showroom of NCR. It's not a bank. Those are just employees faking one to show off their stuff. In the late 1800s, CR stood for cash register. Nowadays, the company makes everything from checkout scanners to ATMs. VP Brian Bailey works with big and small banks on transforming branches.
Banking innovation is going to change more in the next 12 months than it has in the previous two decades. And it's really being driven by the consumer's demand for more convenient services.
That includes more mobile, but even the most brilliant smartphones can't spit out cash. NCR marketing exec Kerry Stanfield shows me a new product that's trying to address that. Just like an NCR client pitch, there's role-playing.
So I'm riding in the car with my friend and I
say we're in a cab and need cash in a hurry. I tell a smartphone app how much money I want, and it shows the nearest ATM. When we get there, there's no card or PIN needed. Basically, all I have to do, I'm going to take my phone's camera and shoot this QR code. Okay, that sound means the machine knows who I am, and here comes $20. Mobile links and video chats are neat as ATMs go, but in many ways, banks are just catching up. After all, many elderly people use Skype to see their great-grandkids. As bankers view it, they don't need to pay for all those teller desks because even grandma's moving on. You'll need to do the same. I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
For all the kids out there waiting in fevered anticipation of the candy they are going to get tomorrow night, there is a not small contingent of adults who are a bit glum, honestly. Halloween is, of course, the end of the scare season. Bad news for the small business people who own and operate haunted houses. And it turns out the business of boo is surprisingly complicated. Lily Rothman from Time Magazine has a story in the new issue. It's called Monsters, Inc. Inside the Weird World of Professional Haunting. Hey, Lily, good to have you here.
Hi, good to be here.
Of the many things that I was amazed to read in this article, of which there were a lot, I will tell you, was of the existence of the Haunted Attractions Association. These guys have a lobbying group, for crying out loud.
Well, there are actually the HHA and the HAA.
You mean there are two?
There are two. The Haunted House Association used to exist as an association. Now it's an information clearinghouse.
But suffice it to say, they felt the need to organize because there's money on the line. This is a business.
Yes, there. It is definitely a big business, and they do have a trade group and a big trade show with about 8,000 buyers a year.
Wow.
That are all professional exhibitors.
It's interesting because we are, you write, and your experts have told you, we are harder to scare nowadays.
Yes, we're very jaded, or most of us.
Yeah. Well, the best. First of all, I don't do scary houses. I don't do scary things at all. So
me neither. I'm a huge wuss.
Thank you. Welcome to the club, and I'm proud of it. But the best quote in this whole article is some guy who runs one of these. He runs a thing called Shocktoberfest, and he says the only way to satisfy customers would be to cut off their arms and slap them upside the head with them. What have we come to?
Well, we've been going to commercial haunted houses for decades now. I mean, the Disney Haunted Mansion opened in 1969, and the haunted house industry has been growing since then. So people who love haunted houses have gone to a lot of haunted houses.
They are pushing the boundaries. Not only are they talking about ripping off your own arm and beating you with it, but there's some guy out there who wants to do a naked haunted house? What's that about?
Well, yes, this was in Pennsylvania, and it was this year. The idea was to get that adrenaline rush for people who have been to a lot of haunted houses, that you would have the option to go through the haunted house in the nude. But it actually got downgraded before it opened to in your underwear.
Thank goodness for that. And there's, I mean, there's no logical conclusion to this. It's going to go forever.
Yes. I mean, well, actually, this year was the first year that the National Retail Federation found that the average American Halloween spending would decrease slightly since they've been tracking this or for the last couple of years. And most of the people I spoke to think that's an aberration. There are many factors that contribute, even the way the calendar shakes out, that the number of weekends in October could contribute to this.
Yeah.
How sports teams do, even an election can affect the way that Halloween is celebrated.
Right.
So most people seem to think that next year Halloween spending will start to tick up again. But I guess time will tell whether we are actually so scared that, you know, we can't be scared anymore, or if things will just continue to get scarier forever.
Who do we blame for the commercialization of this, if anyone? And I say that not pejoratively, but it has become a business as opposed to this thing that I guess we used to do for fun, right?
Yeah. Most people I spoke to trace that back to the 70s. A combination of factors, for example, the movie Halloween, that made Halloween into something that we associated with being actually scared and not just dressing up and getting candy, because trick-or-treating had been around for a long time. But a variety of things in the 70s contributed to making the goal on Halloween is you want to actually be terrified.
No, you don't. No, I don't want to be terrified.
Well, some people do. Some people do.
Yeah. Lily Rothman at Time Magazine. Lily, thanks a bunch.
Thank you.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out today. The rich, it turns out, really are different and perhaps a bit out of touch as well. From a study done by the American Affluence Research Center, this item: families with a net worth of $800,000 or more think the economy is doing just fine. Thank you very much. That is thanks largely to a rising stock market. Also, those families are going to spend an average of $2,175 on gifts this holiday season, which is four times the average amount. All right, we're done. That is Marketplace from APM on this Wednesday. Today, the Dow off 61 points, 0.4%. The NASDAQ down 21 points, more than 0.5%. The S&P 500 gave back 8 points. That is almost 0.5% there. Robbie Carman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, Brendan Willard, and Randy Wine engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.